This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the physician and writer Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, an oncologist, stem cell biologist and cancer geneticist. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His work on the wards, in the lab and on the page explores what he describes as the intersection of medicine, biology and culture. In an era obsessed by genetics, his lab has, among other important things, identified the genes that regulate stem cells. His latest book, The Gene, An Intimate History, was inspired by a desire to understand the recurring pattern of mental illness within his own family. Born in India at the start of the 1970s, as a child he was a gifted singer and took classical Indian music lessons each and every day. Later he studied at Stanford, Harvard and Oxford. These days he lives, teaches and treats patients in New York. He says his clinical work allows him to sit in at a moment of another person's life that is so hyperacute. It's also a moment of hope and expectation and concern. Most days I go home and feel rejuvenated. I feel ebullient. And so, welcome, Siddhartha Mukherjee. You're an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia Medical Center, and you currently spend, I think it's 1 day a week in clinic. A Pulitzer Prize winning author, as we know, and you are a brilliant storyteller. Why is it useful to frame these stories that are in themselves fascinating in this much, much bigger picture of where we are now, where medicine is, where science is?
When I conceive of either the book on the gene or my previous book on cancer in Emperor, I started out by asking, what are we trying to answer here? Why am I interested in it? You know, this thing that envelops culture, that invades, metastasizing into our lives in ways that are so complicated and that we struggle to understand. But in the midst of all of this sort of whir, there is a single human being in some clinic somewhere getting her head shaved because she is anticipating chemotherapy tomorrow, or deciding whether or not to take a drug that is experimental, or signing a consent form to sign up for a therapeutic trial. And her question, his question is very simple. Where are we and how do we get here? Where are we going next? And then the stories become ways to answer that question.
You mentioned the Emperor. You called it, we should tell listeners, of course, it's the Emperor of All Maladies, and it charts the history of the treatment of cancer. Now, I've written here from its first mention in 2625 BC. Is that right?
That's approximately.
Yes, approximately. Yeah, I'm not going to hold you to it exactly. We're all familiar, of course, with the statistics. Between one in two or one in three of us will get a cancer diagnosis in our lifetime. Of course, the reason so many of us will is because, as you explained, it's because we're living much longer. What would you like us, so many of us who will be the patients, to understand about cancer?
Well, one important thing to keep at the front is that this disease, I think, is not going away. The idea that we will erase it from the face of human history, I think, is a pipe dream. It is part of us, not only in a cultural way, but it's part of us in a biological way. There's a biological truth to the idea that the very genes that cause our wounds to heal and our embryos to grow, which give us the capacity to become multicellular organisms with all the beautiful things that come with it, are vulnerabilities. And they're inescapable vulnerabilities. That's the important piece of it. We can't scratch them out of ourselves, of our souls, of our biological beings. And so the two helices, as it were, of cancer in humans are twisted around each other. And that's not to be nihilistic about the treatment of cancer, but it is to recognize that part of the complexity of treating cancer is that there are very few diseases where the fundamental of the disease is so locked in with the fundamental of who we are.
Let's go to the music, Siddhartha Mukherjee. Tell me about your first piece of music. Why have you chosen it?
We start with Billie Holiday because she's Billie Holiday. It's as if she doesn't sing with her voice. She sings with some other part of her being. But I like the lyrics of this song, All of Me. It seems so much a metaphor for the body, for what doctors do, what patients go through.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use them.
That was Billie Holiday and All of Me. Siddhartha Mukherjee, I'm going to ask you the almost inevitable question, which is about the future of medicine. If you can picture us in 10 years' time having a conversation, what can we expect that you think will be the significant and major development in medicine?
I think, particularly in cancer, here's what we've learned about cancer, that detecting cancer early is possible. And if we can avoid overdiagnosis and overtreatment, then detecting cancer early and treating it with the appropriate kind of therapy is effective. Number two is that treating cancer's vulnerabilities that are unique and particular that one cancer is possible and desirable. And number three is that treating the environment around cancer, the immune system, etc., is possible and desirable. So in the next 10 years, we're going to try to deploy this. It's like living on the edge of an experiment. We're going to ask the question, if we do this systematically in cancers, can we learn to treat cancers in a more rational, reasonable way? I think in the next 10 years, we'll see that happening with cancer. And to me, that's extraordinarily exciting.
Our mental attitude to disease is reflected so much in the language we use around it. And of course, the language we use around cancer is battling it and beat it, and the sense in which we are participative in the activity of getting rid of this disease. What do you make of that? And I mean, does it annoy you?
It doesn't annoy me. You know, patients, doctors, me, will have different conceptions of their illness. Some of them actually like battling. There was a time 50-odd years ago when there was a fatalism around cancer. No one was battling it because it was not talked about. And then there was a time 30 years later where everyone was battling it and fighting it because it was thought to be curable. So each of these moments, I think, comes with its own burdens. I think, thankfully, this is part of the ebullience of this moment, thankfully, we're slowly understanding that the biology dictates what happens to you. It isn't you. It's the cancer. And to a large extent, that's true.
Tell me about your next piece. We're going to hear what now?
So this takes me back all the way to my childhood. And I had musical training, which I later abandoned. But I had musical training for years. And it was in Indian classical music. And if you're an Indian classical music aficionado, Ustad Amir Khan is considered one of the greatest of the greats. Malkaon is a rag that's performed usually at close to midnight. And I love this recording because it comes at you. I love the gritty rawness of the voice. It's like thunder in the middle of the night when you wake up and it's raining and there's thunder. So it's an extraordinarily important recording for Indian classical music. Ustad Amir Khan and Raga Malkans. Siddhartha Mukherjee, we know you did this classical Indian music training every day, singing. Do you still sing at all for pleasure? I do. It was probably the most major part of my childhood. When I started, I was 7, once a week. But by the time I was 12, it was every day, except for weekends. And it would be 2 hours a day. And, you know, Indian classical music training, really involves for the first 3, 4, 5 years just doing vocal scales. And it's mind-numblingly boring. And I hated it. And then about 3 or 4 years, once you finish these scales, then all of a sudden, whoever's teaching you says, why don't you sing this phrase? And I think it's a little bit like the feeling that birds have when they leave their nest. All of a sudden, you know, you shake your wings in a particular way and you can fly. It's an astonishing feeling.
Why did you give it up?
Well, partly I wasn't good enough. Do you have
very high standards for that? I mean, good enough for what? You mean for a profession doing it?
Yeah, for doing it at a concert level, yeah.
Your family originally was from Bengal. They moved to New Delhi just as you were born, around about 1970?
That's right. So my father was in Calcutta, and he moved to Delhi actually before I was born and met my mother in Delhi. My mother was from a Bengali family.
Your paternal grandmother came to live with your family. Can you tell me a little bit more about her?
Well, she was a difficult but inspiring character. She had by then already lost one son, who had succumbed to illness, but basically triggered by his bipolar disorder. And another son, so another uncle, was becoming floridly schizophrenic at that time. And so she came to live with us with her son, and they lived in the same room. And she's a powerfully austere person. She had 7 articles of clothing which she would wash every day and wear only those. She cooked her own meals, and she cooked the same meal every day. I mean, I write to think. And until I wrote about it, I didn't fully figure out what it really meant. But the conflict was between her as a protector of her schizophrenic son and my father, who was her favorite child. And so she turned against my father, who was, as I said, her favorite son, in a way that was like a tigress. But the idea of protecting the ill child obviously left a very deep impression on me, I think, and ultimately had an impact on how I chose to live my life.
So much to talk about. Yeah. But of course, we have to fit in this wonderful list, Siddhartha Mukherjee. So tell me about your third.
To contrast with Amir Khan's Thunder at Midnight, I also wanted to play something more lyrical from Indian classical music. Shahid Pervez was beginning to play music at approximately the same time I was growing up. And he's playing Bihag here, an evening melody. Shahid Pervez is now considered, in his 40s and 50s, considered the preeminent maestro of sitar.
That was Shahid Pervez and Raga Bihag. You have spoken then about the diagnosis of schizophrenia within the family, your uncle, and then indeed, I think, another uncle.
2 uncles and a cousin.
And you have written about the fear of these mental health diagnoses in your family as being like toxic waste, is the powerful phrase you used. It's brilliantly descriptive, but I want you to explain more.
A few months ago, I met this woman who had a diagnosis of breast cancer, and her mother and her grandmother had both died of breast cancer. And she had a mutation in a gene called BRCA1. Many people know about it. And she had 2 daughters, and she had gone ahead, and with partial consent, she had actually screened those 2 daughters, and only one of them had inherited the mutation. And these 2 daughters were pre-adolescent. They hadn't even developed breasts. And yet she knew one of these daughters carried a genetic mark that in some distant future would increase her propensity for having the disease that had killed this woman's mother and grandmother, you know, maybe by 5-10-fold. And fundamentally, the 2 daughters could no longer be the same for this woman. Basically, that knowledge would be toxic for her. That's the kind of idea I was trying to get at. Once you learn about genetic propensities in your family, particularly perhaps for mental illness, that knowledge becomes a kind of toxic waste. You're always anticipating it in your own children. You're wondering whether, you know, that tantrum is adolescence or some kind of moment of breakdown.
And what about in yourself?
I think in yourself, at least for myself, that same knowledge has kind of granted me a kind of immunity. It meant, God, you know, if it happens, it happens. I know what it looks like. And as long as I know what it looks like, I'm okay. Because it was so close, you know, watching in this back room where my grandmother and my uncle lived, watching him sort of slowly unravel mentally. You watch it happen. You see the kind of unspooling of thoughts, ideas.
As you were a teenage boy with your father, with your mother, was it talked about what was happening?
We talked about it a little bit. You know, we didn't even have the vocabulary. At first, the vocabulary was he's strange. Then the vocabulary became he's ill, he's depressed. We didn't even know the word schizophrenia. We didn't have the vocabulary, except for those words, strange, depressed.
Frightening?
Frightening, frightened. He was frightened himself. He was frequently frightened himself.
And were you frightened?
You know, I was very fond of him. I wouldn't describe myself as frightened. It was kind of a dark comedy, because he was very indulgent with me. He would take me on these trips and often get lost. I remember one particular time that he lost me in one of these big Indian street fairs, which can go on for miles. And I remember someone from home being dispatched to bring me back.
Some more music, Siddhartha Mukherjee. Tell me about your next. We're on your fourth.
I was very late to the jazz party, which was unusual because, of course, the connections between jazz and Indian classical music are so apparent now, both improvised, both rhythmically complex, both melodically similar. But once I discovered it with all these parallels, I became addicted. And I discovered Monk when I was in Oxford. And I think Round Midnight might have been the first recording that I heard.
Thelonious Monk and Round Midnight. Siddhartha Mukherjee, you say of the work you do right now on cancer, the bench work, if you like,
yeah,
in your laboratory, that 99% of it will be unsuccessful. Seems like a rather dispiriting rate to live with.
Well, the 1% is successful.
I get that.
Exactly. So, you know, I think being in medicine and certainly being in science, that's the bargain you take. The 1% that's successful, of course, is the phenomenal 1%. That 1% will change your life and change our lives in ways that are unimaginable.
I know, of course, that there is not a moment of discovery.
Yes.
There is, of course, a path to discovery and
yes,
a journey on which you and your team are
yeah,
together. But at the point at which you know you're onto something
yeah,
and you know that thing is game-changing, describe
yeah,
that.
Robert Sapolsky, who's a writer, described it once to me. He was actually a professor at Stanford. He described to me as if all of a sudden you get handed and you get to own a little slice of the universe. I like that idea very much, that you feel as if you've opened a trapdoor and discovered a piece of the natural world. It's an entirely addictive feeling. And like all kinds of addicts, we live for that. Hi. I remember when I was working on Epstein-Barr virus at Oxford, I very clearly remember when I began to understand why this virus might escape the immune system. I remember the experiment that I did. I remember the night it was done. I remember coming in at night, reading in those days we used to read, this was all done radioactively. These days we don't do radioactively, but you had to sit in front of the counter and it was excruciatingly slow because it would read one well by another well, and there were 96 wells to be read. and you would sit by the counter and you had to watch it because, of course, it was glowing with radioactivity. And I remember sitting there, and from the numbers, I knew that the experiment had worked, and then we repeated it several times. But I think I went home and went to sleep. there was no one to celebrate with.
Some more music, Siddhartha Mukherjee. Tell me about your next one then. We are on your fifth.
Yeah, so actually five, six and seven are related. And they're related because they are riffs on the idea of how music from India makes its way into so many different places and different forms. The next one is Vijay Iyer, a great jazz composer and pianist working out of New York and other places. And this piece is called Galang. What you'll hear is this piece in which you hear this syncopated rhythm. And this rhythm is exciting, and I like the liveness of it.
Vijay Iyer and Galang. I wonder, Siddhartha Mukherjee, if you will indulge me, humour me a little bit and do some genetics for dummies in the next section. What's the most exciting development in the field of genetics at the moment?
Well, that's relatively clear. We are learning to read the human genome, and by read I mean ascribe meaning to individual variation in the human genome. And we're learning to write, and by that I mean we're learning how to make deliberate changes in our own genetic code.
So we are about to be able to edit our own stories.
That's right. Just to be very clear about one important idea, most people who study genes know that genes plus environment plus chance are involved in giving rise to human traits and human fate and so forth. It's not genes alone. But that said, genes have emerged as a powerful force in that equation. And being able to read, being able to understand how genetic variation in humans intersects with chance and environment and other genes to produce human variation is an important idea because, of course, that allows it to understand what the information is in the human genome. And then on the flip side, as you're saying, being able to edit that information, being able to change that information gives us unprecedented power. The question that the gene asks, the book asks, is what happens to a machine that learns to read and write its own instructions? What would happen if a machine began to write its own instruction manual? For human beings, we are there now.
So that science of heredity and being able to interrupt these stories, change them, edit them, influence them indelibly. When you spoke earlier about the patient of yours with the BRCA1 gene and said that she knew that one of her daughters, who wasn't even yet pubescent, carried the gene and the other did not, you sounded like you didn't think this was a terribly good piece of information to be carrying.
No, I should say that I think it's important piece of information to be carrying. It's what we just have to understand. I'm not sure we're ready to digest this moment, which is to say that the changes that our understanding of genes force us to encounter are enormous, and we can't go blindly into this arena. You know, I'm a physician. I would love to be able to prevent breast cancer by screening a woman who has a higher risk in a way that is appropriate for her to be screened without overdiagnosing her, without overtreating her. This would be a wonderful thing. I'm a physician. I would like to be able to give a woman or a man the possibility of knowing what diseases they may or may not have in the future so that they can prepare themselves, whether medically speaking, however it might be. I think that there are incredible incredibly important positive things that come out of it.
But you also write about the idea that in doing that, what we also do is we eradicate our vulnerabilities. We take away potentially our sensitivities. You know, in life we are in death. This is part of who we are and how we are.
Absolutely. And the importance, I think, is to now tread a relatively narrow road between understanding and predicting what will happen to us in the future based on genetic information, and allowing us the capacity to remain variable and vulnerable and different.
More music. Siddhartha, tell me what we are going to hear next. This is your sixth disc of the day.
I'm glad we talked about vulnerability and language, because Juan Moneo, the great flamenco vocalist, in fact, there's a theory that flamenco music really originates in India. So you'll hear, at least to my ears, an immediate connection to Amir Khan. The same rawness of the voice, the same grittiness of the edge of the voice, the same pathos, of course. Juan Moneo was considered, people have called him the saddest voice in flamenco. I sometimes think of him as the saddest voice that exists.
Bajo da esta farola, that was Juan Moneo there. Siddhartha Mukherjee, I've seen some very beguiling photographs of you and your wife, I think, in American Vogue. You surely look like the golden couple. How did you meet?
My wife, Sarah, is a sculptor. I knew Sarah's work before I knew Sarah. And we met through a common friend, actually, who worked in Sarah's studio, but also was a student at Oxford. But I had admired Sarah's work for years and years. And I found it, I think I can say this, I found it connected to my own work. All the sculptures had a physiology to them. And of course, addressed the question of information and how does information travel within the sculpture itself. So, of course, I was fascinated and that's how we met.
You have two children. Is it true that when your first child, your daughter, was born, one of the first things that occurred to you was harvesting the umbilical cord for treatment for children with leukemia?
Yes, it is true. It is true. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience either, because the person who delivered our oldest child, I was a doctor in the same hospital, and even the anesthesiologist was a friend. It's interesting. I think when Leela was born, I went frankly mad for a while. I think it happens to other doctors as well, that intense moment when something is happening to you, or in this case really to Sarah, and you want to control every piece of it. So I went frankly mad. I should have actually gone and seen a psychiatrist at that point in time. I didn't. Umbilical cord blood has blood stem cells, and I use cord blood to transplant patients with leukemia. It's an incredibly precious resource. So I wanted to make sure that Leela's cord blood was banked, not for herself as much as in case anyone needed it. So the person who was doing this was the obstetrician. And I was hovering over her, telling her, no, don't put the bevel in leftwise, put the bevel in rightwise, because that way you'll get the best harvest. And she looked at me as if, I mean, why are you in this room if you're not going to be the father? If you're going to be the father, then shut up and allow me to deliver the child. But if you're going to hover and tell me what to do constantly and interrupt things, then, you know, we just have to get someone, you know, hospital security to take you away.
Did you shut up?
I finally shut up, yes.
Well done.
It took some while.
Some more music. Tell me what's next.
Next by Philip Glass, because again, and Glass has written about it himself, inspired by this kind of cerebral, circular, meditative quality of Indian classical music that he learned from many, many people. And this ruminative quality, this mathematical quality, which really somehow looks like a sequence to me. And the name, Metamorphosis, we're in the process, I think, as we learn to read and write human genomes with all the caveats I told you before, we are going to metamorphosize as a species.
That was Philip Glass, Metamorphosis 5. Siddhartha Mukherjee, what can we best do ourselves, given that so much of your life is involved in probing our genetic inheritance and how that influences our health outcomes? Is it worth taking care of ourselves? Is it worth eating our broccoli and having one glass less of wine? Honestly?
I think what's interesting, actually, if you look at some of the studies in genetics these days, the influence of behavior for certain kinds of genetic risks can be enormous. There's a nice study that shows that, you know, if you have an elevated genetic risk of cardiovascular disease, you can nearly bring down the risk to baseline by modifying your diet. Now, of course, cardiovascular disease is a powerful disease that's modified by the environment, in this case, the diet. Other diseases, less so. We have to go through it case by case. I don't think there's going to be a magic formula here.
How has your work affected your attitude to your own mortality?
I think it's simplified things for me. I was very intrigued and moved by two other books in recent times, Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, who I know has been on your show, and Paul Kalanithi's book, When Breath Becomes Air. They're telling us something about the human body and how ultimately we're programmed to die and what that means. Where do we stop treating? Where do we start thinking about the end is a question that I think will occupy us for the next 50-odd years as we make new advances in cancer therapy in particular.
What's your relationship with solitude? You know, I'm about to cast you away all alone to this island. How will that be?
I love solitude. You know, one thing that music, or at least training musically, makes you love is silence. And, you know, when I thought about putting this together, actually the thing that came to mind was not so much a desert island, but was a journey in space. These are the 8 things that I would take with me to space. And if I was woken up suddenly in the middle of it, I would like these 8 things to listen to for the next 200 years while my spaceship was taking me to Mars or something like that.
Let's hear then your final piece, your final choice today.
The final choice is, it actually goes back to solitude, because at Oxford, I would run around Port Meadow by myself, usually at night after I'd finished working in the lab, and I needed something to run to, and I would almost always listen to the same piece over and over again. It was none other than the great Aretha herself. It's nice, this is bookended by Billie Holiday and Aretha Franklin, but I needed something a little bit more upbeat and optimistic and peppy, but also strong. So here we have Respect.
Franklin and Respect. I give everybody the books who is a castaway on Desert Island Discs, Siddhartha. So you will get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You get to take another book of your choosing. What's yours going to be?
Well, I would take the complete works of George Orwell. I find him refreshing to read. Sometimes he's a slap in your face, but there's a kind of clarity, a lucidity that comes with seeing the world for what it is and pointing out all its perversities, but also some of its beautiful things.
You may have that then. We allow our castaways a luxury. It can't be anything practical, really. What would you like to take
tonight? Oh, I have so many non-practical luxuries, but I'll take two, but I can choose one of them. Okay. So one you already talked about is silence. There's plenty.
Yes, you can have that for free.
But the other one is a microscope. Every morning really begins at the ritual for me. When I go to the lab or even when I'm going to see patients, I look at biopsies. And if I was sitting in a desert island somewhere, I had nothing else to do, at least that'd be the whole subvisual world. I could look at all the beetles and the things that were on the island and discover a whole new world with them. So that would be my luxury, a small, portable, light microscope.
Would you worry about getting grains of sand in
there? No, I would be very, very careful with
this. All right. In that case, it is yours. If you had to save one of these eight discs from the waves, which one would it be?
It might have to be Billie Holiday.
It's yours. Siddhartha Mukherjee, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find more interviews with comedians, artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs.
This is the BBC.